who are living in the temples, they should also accept these material roles to teach the others. You know, this, yeah. The Varnashram system, the Daivi Varnashram system, has to be organized by the pure devotees.
Yeah, their highest mission is to serve the spiritual.
And yes, and they should all be considered better than Brahmins. You know, a Vaishnava who is following his vows. But still, someone may be a very strict sadhaka. You know, he's been chanting Hare Krishna for 30 years, but he's got a passionate nature. He's an administrator, not a scholar. So he should do kshatriya work. It's like Dronacharya. You know, he was a rishi, but he did the work of a warrior, because that was, he had that, you know, warrior nature also.
Yes.
No, but he was, I mean, selling his Vaishya work. Yes. But he's Paramahamsa. Yes, he can be all, you know, everything at once. Most people can't do that without, you know, cracking. But no, but it is selling is Vaishya work. So a transcendental personality can also do the work of a Vaishya, but it is the work of a Vaishya. And if someone has, you know, the nature that all he likes to do and all he can do well is make money, that doesn't contradict that he's also, you know, first class or second class, you know,
if I get the first part, these are the things the spiritual master takes into consideration.
Yes. So at the same time as we have our transcendental identities, you know, we are, you know, practicing sadhakas, strictly following our vows and our guru's instructions. At the same time, we can accept different roles in the varna system. I can be a Vaishnava and do the work of a Shudra. You know, it doesn't contradict my being a Vaishnava. I'm just acting externally as a Shudra, doing the Shudra work. It doesn't make me a Shudra. Someone else who can't follow the regulations, we can engage actually as a Shudra. But the Vaishnava teaches how to be a Shudra by acting externally like a Shudra. Not just like Prabhupada himself got on the floor and taught us how to clean the temple floor. You know. So he did the work of a Shudra. Now, just teach. The teacher can do the work of all the classes. Brahman is the teacher, or the Vaishnava. But he should also act in the different material roles, especially according to his body and his mind's propensities. So, you know, it's not the fault of ISKCON that we have too much passion. How about build this movement on the basis of our passion? We utilize our passionate energies. And we should continue to utilize these passionate energies, but it has to be tempered. And we should cultivate some sattva too, to balance it. And to give it some cool-headed direction, that's all. It's just natural. Yeah. At the same time that we're engaged in pure devotional service, doing purely spiritual work, unless we're Haridas Thakur, we're also doing practical things. And we do whatever we do practically, our practical service, should be assigned according to the nature of our body and mind. Yes, okay. But still, a person is not going to be sad. You know, he can, you know, on his day off on Saturday, he can go out and pick potatoes, you know. But if a person isn't engaged according to his personal tendencies, he's not going to be satisfied. It's not as, if a person is not engaged according to the disposition of his mind and body, if he's engaged in a totally incompatible way with his own nature, conditioned nature, then he won't be satisfied and peaceful. Yeah. Yes. Yes. But anyway, the basic idea of Daiva Varnashram is by separating and designating separate functions of the four varnas, even for practicing sadhakas, it makes it much, it facilitates the spiritual masters engaging their disciples properly. Okay?
Because the other situation is that Arya Guru explained that the Ten Commandments actually included things like preserving yourself. He considered that to be compassionate. Still, you look at yourself as specific designation.
So yes.
You consider yourself and consider yourself in this instance is still as attachment to the material. Even if you consider yourself a non material.
Yes. Yeah, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't identify with our material roles. That doesn't mean we don't play those material roles. Yeah. Among Krishna's, when Krishna was present on the earth and when he was in Dwarka, among his most intimate devotees were the five Pandava brothers. Krishna was so attached to them, he left Vrindavan to go to Mathura and then take everybody from Mathura to Dwarka. He later would leave Dwarka to go visit the Pandavas. That's how attached he was to them. They were engaged, in materialistic, they had material roles. They were engaged in politics, fighting their enemies. But it was Krishna's desire. It wasn't that Yudhishthira was, fighting for a kingdom. But he wasn't identifying that I want to be conqueror of the world. Uddhava explained to Krishna, Yudhishthira wants to perform this Rajasriya sacrifice, not because he's avaricious for power and prestige, not because he wants to be the emperor for his own aggrandizement, but he wants to show, Uddhava explained to Krishna, Yudhishthira wants to show the world. What's the benefit of being your devotee? He wants people to see the difference between how devotees are successful in their life compared to the non-devotees. That was Yudhishthira's motive. So he assumed a big material role, conquer the world, but for the sake of glorifying Krishna's devotees. So we should take the material roles, but not identify with them. Not assume material mentality.
One devotee is working for you all, and Srila Prabhupada is working in that particular room, and then he grabs him up and he starts moving himself. And then somebody steps over there and says, "See, I'm working with you all, I'm showing him how to work with you all. Doesn't mean I do nothing myself. I'm just showing him how to do the same way and say, root issues. Fill in the roles of Varnashram. Not that you become that particular role, but show others. We include the categories of certain such.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. So basically, you're saying that the devotee has to be able to play all these roles. So even
but for the sake of
even one has these grammatical tendencies and he's a very good manager, something needs to be playing.
Okay. Yes. The person who is more thoroughly trained should be competent to do all the work of the person's inferior to him. Brahman can do everybody's work.
The other thing, engage in temple programs, you don't have any sutras, so you'll never get that kind of situation. Because the sutras, their nature is ignorant and spiritual understanding. So when they become, like, once they become initiated, you get some understanding.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sorry, I'll get to you in a second. If a devotee, you know, just doesn't like to read books, as soon as he comes to Bhagavatam class, he falls asleep immediately. You know, he's not, you know, rabbinically inclined like that, but he wants to work all day for Krishna. He chants his 16 rounds without fail, follows the principle strictly, and works all day for Krishna. He's working as a shudra. You know, that's glorious. And, he's a translated situated person. I think we can have plenty of shudras, you know, who are practicing Krishna consciousness properly in sadhana bhakti. You know, they're just externally doing the work of shudras, that's all. It's not, you know, yes, he's no longer a shudra in the spiritual sense, but he's still doing the work of a shudra. And those who are, you know, actually shudra because they can't even begin the process of sadhana bhakti, they will learn from these transcendentally situated persons who are acting as shudras. Well, not everybody is competent to speak well. No, that's true. But the person who is taking out the garbage, if he does it perfectly, that's preaching. Anyone who sees him, you know, is amazed. Such an ideal person taking out the garbage. That's preaching.
So it was chaining the ground?
Yes. And yeah, so you're right to say he's not a shudra, but he's taking the role of a sutra, that's all. Yes, Prabhu? Oh, I'm sorry, I'm nothing. He can do the work of the others, yeah. With limits. He should. What a Brahmin shouldn't do is become anybody's paid servant. He should try to avoid that. Okay, the question is, you know, isn't it that Brahmins are not at all inclined to act as kshatriyas or be kshatriyas? But not all Brahmins are the same. Not everybody is purely in the mode of goodness. So you have many Brahmins who have some passion in them too, especially passion in the brain. You know, Ayurveda, you learn about you know, the different doshas, which represent the different modes of nature. And you've got your physical disposition, you also have a separate subtle body, mental disposition. So you can have pitta in your brain, you know, no physical passion, but you can have a very passionate intelligence. So some Brahmins are interested in politics. Because their passion is in their head and not in their body, they don't, you know, get into the fight directly. But they're behind the scenes as advisors, you know, as you know, ministers to the kings. So they have a sort of kshatriya mixed in their nature, you know, in tendencies to do kshatriya work. And then you have a few rare cases like Dronacharya, you know, who is a Brahmin by birth, son of a sage, very high, very elevated Brahmin, but he's got in him a strong, passionate streak. And he wanted all, you know, as a boy, he just had the urge, had to learn military science. Ended up learning, you know, Karna, well, Karna was a kshatriya. But so you have sometimes, in rare cases, a Brahmin who's, you know, actually picking up arms and participating in fighting. Still a Brahmin. So it's mixed. You have mixed Brahmins who get involved in politics, mostly as advisors.
Is it a kshatriya because he has that quality? Yes.
He's thinking of compassion towards the people who need guidance. And
yeah.
That chapter, sort of nature, there's no chapter sort of compassion.
Yes, and he's got higher education than a kshatriya. And he's got control over his senses more than a kshatriya. And he has, you know, stronger power of austerity. But then, you know, when you get near the borderline, it gets fuzzy. You know, who's a brahmin and who's a kshatriya? Yudhishthira was a kshatriya, but he was a very brahminical kshatriya. And then you have a few brahmins like Dronacharya. You know, he's nominally a brahmin, but he's, you know, one of the biggest warriors. So it's a little fuzzy why Yudhishthira is a kshatriya, not a brahmin, why Drona is a brahmin, not a kshatriya. Yeah, well, he started off as a kshatriya. And over the course of many thousands of years, he turned himself into a brahmin by austerities.
But then, what Krishna is saying in Gita is not so honored that someone shall be in this way. But I was listening to Gita and Gita, you know, that Gita is saying that the Darshan.
Yes.
He's saying that Krishna was not so keen that Dronacharya went by to war.
Okay, you know what everybody should do is aspire to a higher position. So kshatriyas should try to gradually become brahmins, if not in this lifetime, in the next. You know, a kshatriya who does his duty nicely, his reward can be that he can take birth as a brahmin in his next life. But why do it the other way around? Why should brahmins try to become kshatriyas? It's unnatural. It's anyway. It's not progress. It's evolution down. But anyway, Dronacharya and these other personalities—they appear at the end of Dwapara Yuga, where everything was out of balance. Was, you know, too much passion in the world. Krishna himself had to come to balance the situation. So you had abnormalities appearing at that time. Strange births, various persons. Why don't we take a half hour now to continue a little bit, finishing up this encounter between Manu and Gaurdama. So we're up to verse 8. The Brahmana Kshatriya have properly greeted one another. They've acknowledged the other's valuable contribution to society. So now, with the proper introduction having been made, Manu can get down to business. So we read verse 8. Text 18. Sabhavan duriti duhutri sneha parikrishtat manomava shrotam arhasi dinasya shravitam kripaya une. O great sage, graciously be pleased to listen to the prayer of my humble self, for my mind is troubled by affection for my daughter. Just as Kardama was honest and frank in his confession to Lord Vishnu that he had the desire to get married, although there was pleasant words being spoken at the beginning of the conversation, Manu now admits that he has an agenda also. He has some material need that needs to be satisfied. Having material desire is not condemned. The Vedic system provides that you can satisfy the needs of your body and mind. There's proper ways to do everything. So Manu can get his daughter married. Here's the proper time and place, the proper person to deal with. and he can make his request. He's concerned for his daughter. Natural, and in this situation appropriate to discuss. He's talking with the right person. The person's a brahmachari, but he's not a brahmachari who's taken a vow of perpetual celibacy. And everybody knows.
And look at that view.
That's really nice. Thank you.
And look at God, what I want.
Okay, I want one too. He knows. Or other, okay. Thank you, Gord. Thank you. Everybody knows that Kardam is looking for a wife. It's not a secret. So it's appropriate that Madhu can approach him and make the offer. Text 9. Priyavato tanapadau svaseyam duhita mama anvichati patimma yuktam vayakshila gunadivihi. My daughter is the sister of Priyavrata and Uttarapada. She is seeking a suitable husband in terms of age, character, and good qualities. When material arrangements are made, everything should be done appropriately. The marriages should be arranged so that there's compatibility. The Brahmins are responsible for this, so there's astrology is a political science. The sages who wrote the textbooks on astrology, they warn that if a non-Brahmin practices this science, he will go to hell and his customers will go to hell with him. The science is only for Brahmins, those who have very, very sharp intelligence, astrology. And the astrologers, among other services they perform, they match the young men and women appropriately so that the marriages are compatible. If they're not, then there's all sorts of trouble. The prospective wife should be have a similar nature to her husband, but she should not be superior in qualities. Doesn't work well for a marriage, a Vedic marriage. If the woman is smarter or richer, or from a better background of the husband. Yeah, it just causes trouble, according to this, the human nature. Okay, verse 10. Yada tu babatakshila shruta rupa vayo guna ashwino naradad esha twayasi krita nishchaya. The moment she heard from the sage Narada of your noble character, learning, beautiful appearance, youth and other virtues, she fixed her mind upon you. So Narada is again making trouble. He's very often stepping in telling people what's going on. Narada let the young princess know about Kardama. And proper young men and women in Vedic culture don't mix. They don't have an opportunity to meet one another. So the go-betweens have to inform the parents, here's the suitable groom for your daughter, and he's like this and that, because otherwise the girl would never find out. So here Narada is acting as the matchmaker.
Yes.
Oh yes. Yes. Because he had been meditating for 10,000 years. Okay, but by his yogic strength, he still had a young, strong body. Yeah. I mean, generally, young women don't want to marry old men. So this is, at least from the girl's point of view, this is an advantageous quality. Okay, we read 11.
tat prati cha dvijagvema shradayo paritamaya sarva manarupam te ihamedi shukarmasu.
Therefore, please accept her, O chief of the Brahmanas, for I offer her with faith, and she is in every respect fit to be your wife and take charge of your household duties. Okay. This is the best kind of marriage arrangement, Brahma Vivaha, when the father, in good faith, offers the daughter as a gift to a suitable man. The verse uses the word Grihamedi, which Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati and Prabhupada, following him, chose to designate the materialistic householders. You know, we have Grihastas, who are devotees, and Grihamedis, you know, who are entangled materialists. But actually, in ancient times, the word Grihamedi meant someone who's performing Vedic sacrifices in his home. A Vedic Brahmana is a Grihamedi. And they were householders. The sannyasis didn't perform fire sacrifices. Before you take Vanaprastha or sannyas, there is the Prajapatya Ishti, sacrifice, in which you place the fire in your own body, into your abdomen. Merge it with the Vaishvanara fire. And that means you stop once you take Vanaprastha and sannyas, you don't perform the Vedic sacrifice, the fire sacrifices anymore. So that's the domain of the householders. They're called Grihamedis. So that's ancient use of the word, but then in the purport, Prabhupada goes, again insists that there's a distinction, Grihastas and the Grihamedis. The Grihamedis and the Grihastas. From the point of view of the Vaishnavas, yes, even the most pious Vedic Brahmin is a materialist. If he's not practicing Krishna consciousness, no matter how pukka a Brahmana he is, no matter how many soma sacrifices he's done, he's just a materialist. Yes, ma'am. Okay, so you're saying we shouldn't look at people, I guess you mean by people who need devotees. We shouldn't look at devotees' material designations. And therefore, even when we're arranging marriages, better we just let Krishna take control and just match up just anybody with anybody. But we've done that in the past, and it's been disastrous. Now, I would strongly recommend, from my own experience, I don't mean just my own family life, but what I know of other devotees, and I was practicing astrology, and I did a couple of hundred devotee comparisons, and I stopped a number of marriages. I told them, look, this is just totally incompatible. And I saw other cases where they just went ahead. And it's, when there's a very incompatible match that shows up in the astrology, it usually turns into a mess. If this is a principle of Vedic culture, that the marriage should be arranged scientifically, it should be compatible, it shouldn't be a haphazard, it certainly shouldn't be just on the basis of sexual attraction. But it doesn't mean, then therefore if we're going to take that out, it shouldn't be any basis, it just be random. No, not at all. It should be scientifically done. Okay, philosophically, men and women are basically incompatible anyway. For them to actually, live together is very difficult, especially in Kali Yuga. For men and women to live together is very difficult. They have different natures, They think differently. They speak different languages. So better to minimize the risk of marriage by trying to find compatible couples, you know, make it as compatible as possible. Don't just match everybody up haphazardly. You disagree?
No, I was just surprised that you said it many years ago. So that would be different.
Yes. No. If we're on the Krishna conscious platform, then whatever material differences that are there will be totally insignificant. But to the extent that we're still in material consciousness, it's a psychological fact that men and women don't live together very easily. That's why in Vedic culture, even the husband and wife aren't constantly in one another's association. Because they have different natures. The women feel comfortable associating with other women more than with men, and vice versa. Is that controversial? It's just psychological reality. And devotees can transcend that. But that's normal human nature. It doesn't mean, let's outlaw marriage. Most people will end up getting married. But there's inherent difficulty involved. At the same time that it's difficult for men and women to live together peacefully, the sexual attraction is there. So they gravitate to one or another, even though it creates conflict. Anyway, if grihasthas live strictly according to the Vedic standards, or better than that, they strictly follow the regular principles of devotional service, then everything will be peaceful, despite the inherent material difficulties of family life. I mean, I'm talking very theoretically, but it's the way it is. This is Maya's arrangement, that we're attracted to what causes us confusion and pain. We're attracted to sense gratification. And whenever we indulge in sense gratification, it causes trouble. That's the way the material world is set up. It's the tricks of Maya. Yes, ma'am? Yes. Yeah, normally it is. And the astrologers are involved in it. It should be done scientifically. Yes?
It reminds me of an anecdote in the life of Sri Prabhupada. Because the Prabhupada wanted to get into business with money, so he can make a lot of money so he could preach.
Yes.
And he was traveling a lot. And his wife was always arguing with him. He said, we have so much money.
Anyway, if men and women were perfectly compatible, then no one would ever want to take sannyas. So marriages should be compatible, but not too compatible. From the spiritual point of view, they shouldn't be too compatible. Maybe 70%, but higher than 75%, then there could be too much attraction. And then trouble. Aristotle said, by all means, get married. If you get a good wife, then you're fortunate. If not, you can always study philosophy. Not that we should follow Aristotle's instructions. Look at text 12.
Ujyatasya hi kamasya prativado nashashyate api nirmukta sangvasya kama raktasya kim punaha.
To deny an offering that has come of itself is not commendable, even for one absolutely free from all attachment, much less one addicted to sense pleasure. So here, Manu is entrapping Cardinal. He's not going to be able to argue his way out of this. You know, make an excuse that, you know, actually, I was thinking for 10,000 years I wanted to get married, but I'm changing my mind now at the last minute. So in order to prevent that, Manu is arguing that, you know you want this, you've been asking for it, and now that we're offering it to you freely, you have no excuse to refuse. To deny an offering that comes of itself is not commendable, even if you don't have any attachments. This is a free gift. You're supposed to carry out the order of Brahma, so here I'm helping you. What to speak of someone who's addicted to sense pleasure? You're not. You're a great rishi, but you have to set an example for other people. You don't want to show people how to be a false renunciant. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu talked like this with Raghunath Das Goswami. Raghunath Das was so renounced, Krishna's Kaviraj says, the attraction to sense gratification was never touched his tongue. He never had any interest in sense gratification his whole life. But he wanted to join Lord Chaitanya. He ran away from home so many times. His father and uncle had him captured and brought back, kidnapped, to be deprogrammed over and over again. And he ran away again and found Lord Chaitanya. And Lord Chaitanya chastised him. Raghunath Das, perfect, most perfect renunciant that this modern world has ever seen. He told him, Markata Vairagya, Nakoro, Loka Dekaya. Don't be a monkey sannyasi just to make a cheap show to the public. Monkeys are living in the forest just like the sannyasis, but they're just doing monkey business. Indulging in illicit sex with all the she-monkeys. So, although Raghunath Das certainly was not in that category, he had no inclination to sense gratification. Don't let people get a wrong impression. I'm asking you, go home and satisfy your father and mother. And practice Krishna consciousness and patiently wait for Krishna's mercy. Of course, later Raghunath Das joined Lord Chaitanya. Later, he went to Vrindavan and spent 50 years, 47 years, something, years there at Radhakund and practiced, renunciation, austerity like no one else since then has been able to imitate. Krishna's Kaviraj says the regulative principles, the sadhana of Raghunath Das, was like lines etched on a stone, carved into the stone. Can't be changed, can't deviate, impossible. And he was every day offering 2,000 obeisances to all many different Vaishnavas, offering prayers, chanting 3 lakhs of rounds every day, performing great, great austerities, living very, very austere life. So that person, Lord Chaitanya, told him, don't make a cheap show. Don't act like a monkey. So in the same way, if Krishna arranges that we have to accept some material position, even sense gratification, then we have to accept if the spiritual master advises the disciple, although theoretically, that's one order of the spiritual master, a brahmachari can refuse the instruction to get married. Still, spiritual master may very wisely advise a disciple that this is, a change in your material position is beneficial for your spiritual life. Or vice versa. Tell another disciple you should take sannyas. That's the intelligence of the spiritual master to judge these things. But if you have material desire, Krishna, you can trust Krishna to make arrangements. Then when Krishna makes the arrangement, don't artificially reject Krishna's mercy and pretend to be better than you are. Now, artificial renunciation, trying to maintain a standard that you don't have the strength to maintain, can lead to fall down. So that, I think that's what Manu is telling Kardama here. Not telling Kardama that he's a materialist, but you've got some material desires. You're not completely free from material desire, otherwise you wouldn't have done what you've done and talked to Lord Vishnu the way you did, asking for a wife. So therefore, here's your bride, you should accept her. It's a strong argument. I don't think Kardama can get out of this. I don't know. We don't know that he knows that Manu knows that Kardama met Lord Vishnu. But apparently, a lot of people know that Kardama wanted to get married. Narada is going around talking about it. So he knew that Kardama wanted to get married. That much he knew. This appearance of Lord Vishnu was a private audience. I don't think everybody else found out about it. You know, Kardama is a real devotee. Even if he's not going to make a public spectacle of his personal realizations. You know, I saw Vishnu. He told me this and that. That's a cheap devotee. That's business of a sahaja. You know, to make a public spectacle of his private realizations.
Verse 13.
Okay, he's pushing his argument a little further here in verse 13. Yaudyatam anadvitya kinasham abhyachate kshiyate tadyashat spitam manas chavagyaya hataha.
One who rejects an offering that comes of its own accord, but later begs a boon from a miser, then thus loses his widespread reputation, and his pride is humbled by the neglectful behavior of others.
So, Prabhupada comments that Manu is the emperor, but he doesn't feel below his position to go to a poor beggar to offer his daughter. Prabhupada says Kardama doesn't have any worldly possessions. He's living in a hermitage. He doesn't have much in the material way to offer this girl. But he was advanced in culture. His consciousness and his cultured behavior was much more valuable than a big debt and a lot of money in the bank and any other material assets. This is recognized. In Vedic culture, the most valuable asset is your culture, is your character. That can't be bought with money. Prabhupada says, therefore, in offering one's daughter to a person, or in judging people in general, the culture and quality are counted as prominent, not wealth or any other material consideration. So Brahman is honored for his character. Kshatriya is honored for his strength, his power. Vaishya for his wealth. But Brahman doesn't need any wealth and doesn't need any power to establish his reputation. Okay. And one last verse. Text 14.
Aham tva shrinavam vidvan Vivahartam samudyatam atastvam upakuridvana pratam pratigrihaname. Swayambhuva Manu continued, O wise man, I have heard that you were prepared to marry. Please accept her hand, which is being offered to you by me, since you have not taken a vow of perpetual celibacy. So this also, Manu is aware, if you want to get your daughter married, you have to find some young man who's not married yet. So you'll have to go approach some brahmachari, but you have to be careful that the brahmachari that you're approaching intends to marry. Brahmachari life is meant for those who want to remain renounced their entire life. It's the brahmachari period of training is also meant for those who want to get married. One shouldn't marry without first being trained up as a brahmachari. So therefore, in the brahmachari order, we'll find both kinds. And we don't have different colors. One may not know himself, whether he's going to end up in which category. Whether you're going to be a brahmachari 40 years from now or not. Still, the practice is there. The training is the same for both. And then after, traditionally at the age of 25, the graduation ceremony, so to speak, and those who choose to go home and get married, they take their baths, snataka. Those who, after 20 years of training in the Guru's ashram, they decide, okay, now I want to go out in the world and raise a family. They take the blessings of the Guru, they give him suitable dakshina. Dakshina should be given at the end of the education. If you pay a teacher in the beginning, then that is just a business deal. But the Vedic system is the student at graduation offers a gift to the Guru. And then those who want to get married, they get their blessings, take their bath, and go home. Those who want to stay, at that point they decide, at the graduation time, that they want to remain also renunciates. So they remain with the Guru, and eventually they go off and start their own ashrams. Okay, so now an offer has been made. It's up to Kardama to accept or not accept. That's the last section we'll read tomorrow. Any final comments? Okay, we can stop here. Thank you. All glories to Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. They get together only here because the daughter has to be exchanged. The princess has to be married to the sage. After this short exchange, Manu is going to go back to his kingdom. He's not going to stay with his daughter in the ashram. Daughter will be left behind. The mother and father will go back home, and that's the end of the exchange. Brahmins and the Kshatriyas stay separate, except when they have some business together. But whatever encounter did happen is mutually respectful, mutually friendly. Okay. Read the next verse, 16. Kardama speaking.
Kama sabuya naradeva desya putriya samam naya vidhau patitaha ko eva tetanayam nadriyeta svaya eva kantya kshipatim eva shriyam.
Let your daughter's desire for marriage, which is recognized in the Vedic scriptures, be fulfilled. Who would not accept her hand? She is so beautiful that by her bodily luster alone, she excels the beauty of her ornaments. So, O Naradeva, first line, you are like a god among men. I have to respect your request, the Brahmana is telling the king. You are the representative of God. I don't have to obey everything you say. I'm autonomous. But still I have to take your opinion seriously. If you offer me this charity, I should not callously refuse it without a good reason. And this is all in order. The girl's desire is legal, is sanctioned by the Vedas. A daughter has to be married. This is the order of the Vedas. Otherwise, the father is going to go to hell. You're the king. I shouldn't let you go to hell. And she's suitable. I'm looking for such a wife, of course. Why not accept? Then in the next few verses, Kardava praises the qualifications of Devahuti, of the prospective bride. 17 and 18.
Yam harmya prishte kwanad angri shobam vikridatim kandruka vihvalakshim vishvava surnyapatad swad vimanad vilokya sammoha vibhuda chetaha.
I have heard that Vishvavasu, the great Gandharva, his mind, stupefied with infatuation, fell from his airplane after seeing your daughter playing with a ball on the roof of the palace. For she was indeed beautiful, with her tinkling ankle bells and her eyes moving to and fro.
Tam partayandim valanalalamam asivita sri charanaya radvishtam vatsa manur uchapadak swasaram konanu manyeta buddho biyatam.
What wise man would not welcome her, the very ornament of womanhood, the beloved daughter of Swayambhuva Manu, and the sister of Uttanapada? Those who have not worshipped the gracious feet of the goddess of fortune cannot even perceive her. Yet she has come of her own accord to seek my hand. So Vishvavasu was a little foolish. He shouldn't have allowed himself to become infatuated with this girl. She wasn't meant for him. So that's foolishness. And he fell out of his airplane. But for Kardava, this is appropriate. You know, we should be honest. He's attracted to this girl, but he's entering into an entanglement. But a Brahmin is supposed to be pure and have as little as necessary to do with the material world. But he has to be honest. When he has material attachments, they have to be satisfied. Most people have to eat. Goswamis of Vrindavan conquered that, eating and sleeping. They practically stopped altogether. But who else can do that except for Rupa Sanat and Raghunath Das? So most people have to find food twice a day, three times a day. They have to sometimes defend themselves. And some people have to make some arrangement for association with the opposite sex. This is just unavoidable for most people. So here, the Brahmin, although he's a great sage, great performer of austerities,
He's admitting his limitations and honestly accepting the arrangement provided by the Supreme Lord and the charity being offered to him by Manu. Okay, but in the next verse he says, Yato Baba Vishnu. No, skip the verse. Thank you. Yeah, okay. Ato Bajishye Samayena Sadvim Yavat Tejo Vibriyat Atmanome Ato Dharman Paramahamsya Mukhyan Shukla Proktan Bahumanye Vihimsran. Therefore, I shall accept this chaste girl as my wife on the condition that after she bears semen from my body, I shall accept the life of devotional service accepted by the most perfect human beings. That process was described by Lord Vishnu. It is free from envy. So here, this is how powerful this Brahman is. His mind is infatuated. He's attracted to this girl. But still, he can draw the line. You know, I'll have children by her. As soon as the children are born, I'm leaving. This happens. In chapter 24, we'll read how, we won't read, but if you pick up the book, you can read how Karna had the 9 daughters. Devahuti was not satisfied. She wanted one more child. That child was the Supreme Personality of God. And as soon as he was born, or very soon after, Kardama did what he said he was going to do. He left home. Not to be imitated. If you have a child, you should take the responsibility to raise the child. But in this case, Devahuti was provided for. She had many servants. And the son was the Supreme Personality of God anyway, and the pastime was that he was meant to give instruction to her. Yes, please. Yeah, please. We could, any discussion?
Well, the reason why
he wouldn't. Yes, it was usable. The dovetailing of that material desire was, in a very practical way, usable in devotional service. You know, to have to feel it as your son, and it was under control. It was, you know, everything was being done properly according to regulations, and Kardama had the determination to get himself out of that entanglement, not to stay in it permanently. Therefore, it was sanctioned. Vishnu encouraged it, sanctioned it. Yes. Just explain various places in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna Kaviraj has Krishna talking that I'm, you know, the supreme mystic. Why will I allow my devotee to make a fool of himself? He's begging for what will harm him. Why should I let him have that? Or in speaking to Uddhava, Krishna says in the 11th canto, Yasyaham anugraham rinami adishyeta tadam shanai. If I really favor my devotee, I don't give him everything he asks for. In fact, I gradually deprive him of all his assets. And then his family become disgusted with him and kick him out. That's my ultimate favor. If I'm really kind to a devotee, if I recognize that he's really serious, then I smash him materially. But in the case of a great devotee who has a special service to do, like Kardama in this case, like Yudhishthira, who became emperor practically of the whole world, great power, but he didn't misuse any of it. He never forgot Krishna. So great devotees like that, Krishna can give them all material benefits, and they don't there is some entanglement there, but they don't lose grasp of their Krishna consciousness. Yes, Prabhu? Yes? Well, what do we mean when we say there's no material impediment to devotional service? Does that mean go ahead and do any material thing? Yeah, there's no need for rules and regulations then. Stay in your Varnana Ashram, but don't get too entanglement, too entangled. There's, Lord Chaitanya warned, there's two kinds of non-devotees. The atheist can't be accepted as a devotee, and the person who becomes too materially entangled. Even a sincere devotee can lose his taste for hearing and chanting because he just, you know, his intelligence becomes distracted and dulled by Maya's allurements. It can happen to anybody. So therefore, it's, you know, what does Prabhupada say? There's danger even on the royal road. On this verse, Raga Dvesha that attraction and repulsion are the eternal enemies of the soul. One should be very careful. Don't come under the control of material attraction and repulsion. And Prabhupada says in the purport, to be careful, even on the royal road, there's all sorts of dangers. That means that you can think that you can indulge in sense gratification in the name of dovetailing. Be careful. Anybody can become distracted and lose their taste for hearing and chanting.
Would you find this as an example of repulsion?
I don't think he's not repelled by this girl. He's very happy to take her as his wife. No, I don't think it's out of he doesn't leave his wife because, I don't like this wife anymore. I've been with her for 3 months. I want to find another one. He's not repelled by her. But he just is determined, Okay, I'll do this, but my real intention is to go back to Godhead. So I'm going to stay in this family life only as long as required. Not out of repulsion, out of intense, strong intention to achieve something higher. That's what we should have. We shouldn't be. Krishna said, don't be pushed by attraction or repulsion. Both of them are dangerous. Because then we falsely renounce. Pa-pancha-kataya buddhya hari-sambandhi vastunaha mumukshya bi parityago vairagam palgukatyate. If we thinking that, this is material. This woman, this child, these are my material impediments. So thinking it's material, you reject it, but hari sambandhi, they're connected to Krishna. So you give up things that are actually belong to Krishna or are meant to be used in Krishna's service, and you reject them whimsically, that's called useless renunciation. Just the opposite of that, Rupa Goswami quotes that together